Buenas tardes, good afternoon. You're listening to Relato Zapatista. We're here broadcasting on Berkeley Liberation Radio, 104.1 FM. And I'm here in the studio with Alita, Kayla, and El Profe. Yo soy Filemón, or Filé. And we're going to be talking this afternoon, Sunday afternoon, Super Bowl Sunday. We're going to be talking a little bit about alternative media, and specifically alternative radio. And we're really interested. I mean, obviously, we're producing alternative radio. We're doing some pirate broadcasting here. And we're interested in the way that radios and alternative radio collectives and alternative media collectives in general engage in social struggle and political struggle, and the ways that those sort of struggles get shut down, the way that the state tries to move in and intervene and shut them down in different ways. So it can be anything from state intervention directly. It can be state-sponsored goons, thugs sent out to attack people and burn down their radio stations. It can be anything from local administrations at universities, for example, sending people out to beat up the people who are producing alternative media. And so we're just going to start talking a little bit about that. That's sort of the theme that's going to run through our show this afternoon. And we're going to also bring you directly from Chiapas and Mexico some updates of the situation that's going on over there and updates from around the world. So we're really interested in the struggles desde abajo y a la izquierda, from below and to the left, grassroots struggles that don't go through official political means. We're going to start it off with a musical interlude, and we'll be back with some information.
Just born, like my life just started and it's time to take charge. Yeah, my heart's been torn, but my heart's still pure. I endure what didn't kill me, just made me more strong. Only made me more sure that I need a little more. Need to go a little hard, make my living more secure. Gotta leave a richer legacy my kids can't afford. Instead of leading them astray, when I leave they won't be lost. Gotta teach them what's the reason that our freedom fighters fought. And the consequence of course, just for us to have a voice. Just for us to have a choice, so that we can have a vote. Many sacrifice their lives, even died by the rope. All our lives we've been tried and provoked. Now it's time that we rise up and shine and revolt. Blood, sweat, tears, and joy, I cry freedom. Life is a sacrifice to buy freedom. You can't deny freedom. Remove anything in the way of our freedom. I was blind, but I opened my eyes to cry freedom. Blood, sweat, tears, and joy, I cry freedom. You can't deny freedom. Remove anything in the way of our freedom. I was blind, but I opened my eyes to cry freedom. They say the men are homeless and the homes are manless. The government corrupt and the church is scandalous. The queens of our nation is strip club dancers. And the Food and Drug Administration giving us cancer. Too much radiation, cell phone preoccupation, no education. Schools is just indoctrination. My dream is to flee the plantation on a river of blood, sweat, tears to liberation. Visions of rebellion like the struggles in Haiti. I ride like Tucson and did Mark Facey. Or Yasantiwa, be a Shanti nation. To the struggle, we all have an obligation. Some say we living in times of revelation. War everywhere, economic devastation. So hungry we hallucinating, thinking that we free already when we still on the plantation. And it's gonna get worse before it get better. But when you know it's gonna rain, if you smart, you get an umbrella. It's till we free like Winnie Mandela. No sellout, committed like Fannie Lou or Ella. Asada, Matulu, Maroon, Sundiata, Nahanda, Lil Bobby, no way we ain't forgotcha. In the spirit of the pandas in the mile mouth for this generation, be the time is right now. Blood, sweat, tears, and joy, I cry freedom. Life is a sacrifice to buy freedom. You can't deny freedom. Remove anything in the way of our freedom. I was blind, but I opened my eyes to cry freedom. Cry freedom,
yo. Cry freedom.
I remember Huey was running through Oak Town to echo Hoover brought in the dope. Now it's broke down, burnt down, building the project.
You're listening to Berkeley Liberation Radio on 104.1 FM. Y están escuchando Relatos Zapatistas. Here are our news briefs. In Canada, a call out has gone out for anti-Olympic activists from across the continent to clog the streets of Vancouver and disrupt the first full day of the Winter Olympics. Details of the planned February 13th street march called 2010 Heart Attack Clog the Arteries of Capitalism, appeared Friday on InfoShop News, a U.S.-based anarchist website and Vancouver's Olympic Resistance Network site. For months now, a loose coalition of anti-Olympic, anti-global, anti-poverty, and anti-capitalists have been organizing protests to take place at the Games. Olympic security is responding with more than 15,000 police, military, and private security guards, and a total security budget of $900 million. For more information about this action, log on to olympicresistance.net. Here in the Bay Area, the call has gone out. On March 4th, students, workers, and teachers throughout the nation and across the globe will strike. Pre-K through 12, adult education, community colleges, and state-funded universities will come together in an international strike and day of action to resist the neoliberal destruction of public education in California and beyond. Occupy California say, "We stand beside all who wish to transform public education, and we seek to advance the struggle by generalizing the tactic that has by far been the strength of the movement, that is, direct action. In keeping with the spirit of March 4th, we call upon everyone everywhere to occupy everything, from collapsing public universities and closed high schools to millions of foreclosed homes. We call on all concerned students and workers to escalate the fight against privatization where they are, in solidarity with the California statewide actions. We envision a network of occupied campuses in multiple states across the nation. We call upon all Bay Area students, teachers, and workers to unite on March 4th to march from Berkeley into downtown Oakland. We encourage all those in the Bay Area to organize actions alongside and in support of the occupation movement so that March 4th becomes a day of blockades, sit-ins, mass marches to the streets and freeways, a day for reclaiming public spaces and institutions. In solidarity with hundreds of occupied schools and workplaces across the globe, we seek to make March 4th an international day of action demonstrating our collective resistance." You can find more information on Occupy California website, which is occupyca.wordpress.com. From Oaxaca, three U.S. tourists and one Uruguayan citizen were arrested in Oaxaca City on Thursday, January 28th, after approaching Ulises Ruiz in the city Zocalo and asking him about the murder of Indian media activist Brad Will. A press release from Oaxaca posted on January 30th, 2010 explains that the four persons detained, Andrea Caraballo, Guadalupe Rodriguez Lopez, James Wells, and Jennifer Lawhorn, asked the governor Ulises about the case of Brad Will, which to this day remains unresolved. 5 minutes later, between six and eight police agents, some in official uniform and other dressed in plain clothes, surrounded them and forced them to get into the back of the truck. The police refused to give any information. The detainees were humiliated and threatened and spent the night in jail. The next day, Friday, January 29th, they learned that they were being accused of assaulting two police officers and damaging a police radio valued at about $3,000. Their attorney informed them that for a lack of evidence, they were going to be set free without charges and without having to pay bail.
Washington que valga, un bolívar de mi cuenta, ni un sucre de mi plata porque vale lo que pesa. No empecé el pase de un empréstito sorpresa, no habrá peseta que pueda saldar su deuda. Cuento y cuenta ante una comarca en India, que lo dio todo en un día en el que se hundía. Toda una raza en el nombre de Cristo, en nombre de su carne y Juan en su bautizo. Pasaron siglos y hubo entierros en la sierra, y hubieron tierras y hubo imperios de la selva. Que volverían de la ruina a coronarse cuando el vaquero con su caballo salvaje hacia un rancho más acá de la frontera se fue a lo macho a imponer esa bandera. Y hubo caciques que entregaron en bandeja de plata el oro, fruto de la encomienda. Visor de Cusco, el fuego de tus minas. Hoy Manco Capa, que sendero que ilumina. Cortes ilustres de las majestades incas. Al sol de Lima le robaron la alcancía. Y Tenochtitlan, Zócalo.
As one of our regular segments here on Relatos Zapatistas, we include an overview of this month in Zapatista history. So now, today, for the month of February, we'll be looking at a few key moments in Zapatista history, starting with an event that actually took place before the public uprising of the Zapatistas in 1994. On February 27, 1992, under President Carlos Salinas de Gortari, Article 27 of the Mexican Constitution was revised, effectively ending 75 years of land reform and allowing for the privatization of ejidos, communally owned land. For many landless campesinos across Mexico, this revision of the Constitution effectively marked the end of any hope of ever owning land. This constitutional revision directly paved the way for the passage of the North American Free Trade Agreement, also known as NAFTA, in 1994, which is seen by many, including the Zapatistas, as a direct assault on the indigenous peoples of Mexico. As we all know as well, January 1st, 1994, the day that NAFTA went into effect, is the day that the Zapatistas publicly came out in opposition to these trade agreements and declaring war on the Mexican government. Fast forward to 1994. On February 21st, 1994, over a month after the initial uprising on January 1st, the Zapatistas entered the city of San Cristóbal de las Casas, Chiapas, once again to begin negotiations with the government in the Cathedral of San Cristóbal. The bishop, Samuel Ruiz, a longtime supporter of the indigenous communities of Chiapas, served as the moderator. From the cathedral, the Zapatistas articulated the importance of peasant and indigenous peoples' rights to land. The cathedral dialogues lasted until March of 1994, and during this time, 24 tentative agreements were reached based on the government's response to 34 demands of the EZLN. The government refused to make commitments regarding political issues on a national level. The EZLN declared that the results of the talks would be submitted to a long consultation among all the Zapatista communities and civilian bases of support. In 1995, on February 9th, the federal government suddenly announced that arrest warrants were issued for those that it accused of being the top Zapatista leadership, unilaterally breaking the ceasefire and launching a vast military offensive against the EZLN and their communities of support, both inside and outside of Chiapas. The EZLN, however, retreated into the mountains, as did most of their support bases, and refused to return fire against the government troops. The actions by the army forcefully displaced over 20,000 campesinos. On February 16, 1996, following a prolonged consultation with the indigenous civilian bases of the EZLN, the Zapatistas and the federal government signed the first set of accords resulting from the Dialogue of San Andres. 40 pages of national reforms were set to be undertaken regarding indigenous rights and culture. EZLN Comandante David warned, however, quote, "This is only a small agreement on paper. We will not be tricked into thinking that what has been signed is a peace agreement." In 1997, on the first day of February, 9,000 civilian Zapatistas marched through the city of San Cristóbal de las Casas, Chiapas, demanding that the government honor the San Andres Accords on indigenous rights and culture, and that it accept the COCOPAS constitutional reform proposal. February of 1998 marked the beginning of a government assault on foreigners in Chiapas. On February 26, the parish priest of Chenalo, Father Michel-Henri Jean Chateau de Sillier, was arrested and immediately expelled from Mexico for, quote, "having engaged in unauthorized activities." Both the Interior Ministry and the National Immigration Institute of Mexico acknowledged that Chateau had been expelled for declaring to the press that the government was responsible for the December 22nd massacre of 45 of his parishioners in Acteal. Chanteau, a priest of French origin who had served the indigenous communities of Chenalo for more than 32 years, was the high priest of the eighth priest of the Diocese of San Cristobal to have been expelled from Chiapas since 1994. His expulsion marked the beginning of a campaign to expel hundreds of foreign human rights observers. Over the next 2 years, over 150 human rights observers were deported. February 24th, 2001, fast-forwarding a few years into the future, 24 Zapatista comandantes and comandantas began a two-week caravan from Chiapas to Mexico City to lobby for the COCOPA law. The caravan was called the Marcha del Color de la Tierra, or the Marcha de la Dignidad Indígena. Hundreds of thousands of people greeted the caravan upon its arrival in Mexico City. February is evidently a very busy month for the Zapatistas, as it has been since 1994, and we'll come back to the segment next month with March. We are now going to transition into a musical break. Okay.
The Zapatista community, Morelia, which is in Chiapas, and it's sort of located in between San Cristóbal de las Casas and the city of Palenque, which are two sort of touristic sites of touristic interest. And San Cristóbal is one of the cities that the Zapatistas took over when their sort of revolution happened on June 1st, 1994. Alita was talking about before. And Palenque is a site that has archaeological ruins, big archaeological ruins that have become sort of a big tourist destination. And in between San Cristóbal and Palenque are there's sort of natural sites, Aguas Azules, a big like river waterfall with this crystal clear waterfall, crystal clear water that you can swim in. It's very beautiful. The government wants to develop it as a site of tourism. And so what the Junta de Buen Gobierno was talking about was the sort of the way that the development of a new highway between these two cities that will, you know, is designed to increase, to facilitate transportation of goods and transportation of people, but people who are coming in a very specific mode. They're coming to explore the exotic, to see the other, to spend money at fancy hotels that are owned by foreign capital, that belong to foreign capital, and not necessarily invest in the communities, you know, that they're going through. So instead of developing highways or roads that connect communities, you know, to be able to hold a market in Chiapas, in the highlands of Chiapas, they're building these highways that sort of go in a different direction and sort of facilitate or channel money into very specific hands instead of keeping it out of the hands of like the indigenous people who live in the Zapatista community. So that, the interview is pretty cool that we get to hear directly from the Good Government Council of Morelia in their own words. As we stay in tune with what's going on in Chiapas, we've been seeing that the government and paramilitaries with the government are sort of ramping up the pressure against Zapatista communities as we go into 2010 because of the threat. You know, everybody thinks like 2010 is the 200th anniversary of the War of Independence in Mexico. It's the 100th anniversary of the Mexican Revolution that happened in 1910 or began in 1910. The government in particular is really scared about this year. And, you know, we're really excited to see what happens. So now we've basically done the first part of our show, which is sort of updates on the situation in Chiapas and around the world. And now we're going to sort of move on to the next part of our show, where, as I was saying before in the introduction, we're going to be thinking about sort of asking ourselves some questions about alternative media, specifically in the form of radio, and the sort of play, the dance between alternative radio collectives and organizations that are trying to produce information desde abajo y a la izquierda, and their enfrentamientos, their struggles, their confrontations with the government, with the state, with authoritative bodies that try to shut them down and silence those voices. We're going to start off by listening to a clip from Subcomandante Marcos, the spokesperson of the Zapatista movement, from early 1994, probably in February 1994. We're not exactly sure when this clip is from, the exact date, but it's probably February 1994, where he talks about, to a bunch of radio journalists, the importance of radio journalism, especially alternative media radio journalism.
One, two. Bueno, muy buenos días a todos los que vienen de los medios radiofónicos. Venimos aquí pues para platicar con ustedes y contestarles las preguntas que quieran hacernos. Pero antes que nada queríamos decirles unas palabras por parte de nuestro ejército. Tal vez ustedes no saben lo importante que son para los campesinos y para los indígenas, ¿no? En realidad el medio de comunicación con el que los compañeros enfrentan la realidad local, estatal, nacional e internacional es a través del radio. En ese sentido, para ellos tiene mucho más poder la radio que la prensa o que la televisión o que el cine o cualquier otro medio que en otros lugares tiene más fuerza que la radio. Para nosotros no, en las comunidades, sobre todo donde estamos nosotros, es la radio la que tiene fuerza, ¿no? Precisamente por eso nosotros hemos apreciado especialmente en momentos muy difíciles de nuestra guerra las agencias noticiosas radiales o las estaciones de radio que han hablado con verdad sin ponerse de un lado o de otro de las partes en conflicto, simplemente informando con veracidad lo que ocurre. Para nosotros fue muy importante saber que sí se estaba diciendo lo que estaba ocurriendo y que no estábamos solos. Eso es lo que queríamos decirle. Nosotros esperamos, bueno, queríamos darle las gracias que lo hayan hecho y esperamos que sigan diciendo la verdad, informando a la gente y de esa forma pues contribuyendo también a que haya otras salidas que no sean las salidas de la muerte y la sangre para los problemas que tenemos en este país.
Listening there to a segment from a speech by Suco Anante Marcos, again, that was in early 1994. And what we heard was Marcos really making a case for the significance of particularly radio as a specific form of alternative media and the importance of radio journalism, not only in getting out the voices of popular struggles, but also as an organizing tool that's been used within popular movements and social movements. For a long, long time. You know, it's been a very important organizing tool and has particular forms of accessibility and a particular kind of reach that other kinds of media certainly don't. So this speech from Marcos from 94 resonates pretty significantly with a speech he made in early 2006 in the launching of the Otra Campaña, when he stated that the alternative media is the backbone, functions as the backbone, the sort of support of the other campaign, of La Otra Campaña. In this sense, we understand the role of alternative media, and again, our particular focus on radio, in terms of being a vital tool for getting out the sort of daily occurrences of popular struggles and connecting popular struggles in different sites. So that's what we're going to be sort of looking at here today as we look at examples of alternative radio here in the Bay Area as well as in Honduras. So we'll be hearing some clips from those. But today is a particularly interesting day to reflect on the role of media and the role of alternative media, particularly in the current context of the extreme corporatization of media. Because, as we said before, it is, like it or not, Super Bowl Sunday.
Do we have a score update? what's the score?
Last news, the Saints were down by 7 points, so...
10-3.
10-3. We're hoping the Saints are making a comeback, though. But Super Bowl Sunday, you know, this is the day that sports fans and non-sports fans alike are a little bit fixated on TV and on, you know, sort of mainstream corporate media, because it is the day of the most important advertising of the year in the United States. And so on this day, we can really see sort of the apex of the corporatization of the media as advertising becomes almost as much of a focus as the sports event itself.
And that's something that we're going to see more and more as we start listening to some of these radio segments that we've produced that we're going to be listening to in a little bit, where we talk to, for example, Pirate Cat Radio in San Francisco. And it's a pirate station that is rebroadcast by actual transmitters. So they have an internet feed that's rebroadcast. And, you know, they're trying to exploit loopholes in FCC code in order to sort of legitimize their transmissions. And it's a really interesting, you know, thing it's an interesting point at which to think about this kind of alternative media stuff, because, you know, you could come into it, and I think, like, when we talk to collectives in Mexico, for example, or in Honduras, they might say, well, you know, we don't even deal with sort of their equivalent of the FCC rules. We just transmit, you know, we just occupy, similar to occupying a building, we just occupy the airwaves, and we just do that, you know what I mean? And so that's one strategy that you could talk about. And another strategy would be, well, we're going to try to do it in the most legitimate way possible. We're going to try to understand even better than the FCC does their rules. And that way we'll be able to exploit the cracks and fissures in those rules and sort of sneak our voices through, and in that way fulfill a certain goal. And then obviously that opens, you know, both of those strategies open you up to certain risks, certain kinds of oppression. And maybe, I don't know, that's part of the reason why we would see different kinds of oppression in different places. But bringing it back to the Super Bowl, the whole point is that every place that the corporatization of the media goes, the corporatization of society goes as well. So in Honduras, for example, what we're going to see is that the repression against the radio station goes hand in hand with the development of tourism zones, hotels and stuff like that, similar to what we're seeing in Mexico. So I think that the commercialization or capitalization of both the media and society in general goes hand in hand.
Yeah, and just an update again on the Super Bowl. It's actually 6-10. Saints are still down, but by only 4. But I think another distinction to make, and I think a question that we should be asking ourselves, especially people that are involved in actions or different social movements, is how much are we willing to risk to keep not different forms of media, but I think one thing we were talking about that makes radio interesting versus other kinds of media is that sort of the materials that you need and the space you need in order to keep it going. And sometimes when you need those materials, there's a greater risk that goes with it. So if you need a place to transmit from or a place to put things like the antenna or the transmitter, sort of the scale of what you lose and the risks that government authorities can have on you kind of increases. So how important is sort of analog radio to maybe all of us here in the Bay Area versus, let's say, internet radio or books or flyers? Think later on we're going to talk about actually, we did a news brief on the UC and the public university actions that have been happening and will be happening in March. But what role is the radio playing in that movement, and how much are we willing to fight for it?
So I think now we're going to go into this segment, this interview with folks from Pirate Cat Radio. And this interview, again, is about this radio station located here in the Bay Area in San Francisco. And just for those of you tuning in, we are listening to Berkeley Liberation Radio 104.1, also broadcasting through a live stream at www.berkeleyliberationradio.net. and you are currently listening to Relatos Zapatistas.
Alternative radio, community radio, pirate radio are engaged in different kinds of struggles in different places. Pirate Cat Radio in San Francisco is currently facing a $10,000 fine leveled against them by the FCC. I sat down and talked with Monkey, the founder of Pirate Cat, at the studio that doubles as a coffee shop in San Francisco's Mission District on the corner of 21st and Florida Street.
For the past 13 years, the FCC has really been, like, in our case, like, really nothing more than a paper tiger for most parts. By that, I mean, like, you know, the only thing the FCC will ever do is they would give us paperwork saying you guys have, you know, your 5 or 10 days to turn off your transmitter, stop broadcasting, or show legal evidence that, you know, gives you the right to do so. So I'm like, all right, fine. So in that case, what we would do is every time we got one of those letters from the FCC is just move the transmitter to another location and keep, you know, doing the radio station. So we played the whole cat and mouse game for a while. And then around 2002, 2003, I found this whole, you know, beautiful, what I call the wartime loophole. And, you know, I don't remember the federal code for the whole thing offhand, but that's what I was using for, I'd say, a good 6 to 7 years to keep us on the air. And basically what would happen is anytime we'd put the transmitter up in a location, whoever was hosting the transmitter would have to fill out this, like, you know, boilerplate informal application that's in this clause and send it to the FCC. And it basically states, this is where we're broadcasting from, this is how much power we're putting out, this is how we can be contacted, etc., etc., and this is our reason for utilizing this wartime act. So you're able to enact this anytime the Congress or the President declared war. So the cool thing is, like, obviously the Constitution says only Congress can declare war. And this thing says, well, if the Congress or the President declares war, it's, you know, your civic duty to keep communications with each other by all means possible. It's like, fine. The President declared, you know, George Bush himself, he furthered the war on drugs, he had the war on terror, he had the war on poverty, the war on illiteracy. I mean, the list goes on. There's, like, not just the war on terror, but a slew of other, like, ridiculous wars that the President would declare all the time. So I would always cite all of those and send that off. Like, here we go. We're broadcasting because of all these different wars that we're furthering. The rules of this whole thing is, like, yeah, you have to provide a community service. You can't do underwriting or advertising of any kind. So I was like, all right, how can I create a station format for Pirate Cat that lets us continuously provide community content? So we put together a box of PSAs. All of our PSAs we read are for nonprofit organizations in the area. So we give, you know, these, like, quote-unquote free announcements for nonprofits. Then in addition to that, all the DJs are required to bring in a person to interview for every radio show that's of community interest. It's not about, like, the vanity thing of just playing music. You have this great privilege of being able to utilize the radio and get people to listen to something and give them information, bring in the person to interview. And most people are able to accomplish that. We'd make it really strict, and it's like, if you can't get an interview and book it 2 weeks out, we'll book someone for you, because, you know, that's our community service. That's what we're here for, is to, like, inform people and bring people in that they can hear that they typically wouldn't know about or hear elsewhere. And that's what we did. So everyone's doing that regularly now. We got people coming in. Sometimes it's, like, a comedian, sometimes it's a band, sometimes it's somebody from City Hall, or somebody running a nonprofit organization, or somebody trying to form, like, you know, somebody from, like, Bicycle Coalition or whatever, somebody trying to form something new that will help the community. We'd bring them in and let them talk about what it is they're trying to do and try to get help via the radio to organize themselves.
What do you define as your community?
The Bay Area. I mean, it's kind of weird, because when before we opened up this space here and had, like, the cafe and the public community thing, it was all just, like, what you heard. So whatever our broadcast range would reach is who we were serving. So that's, like, who we have to give content to and give access to the airwaves to. You know, if we're broadcasting out of San Francisco and you can hear us in Fremont, well, shit, not just San Francisco and Oakland, but get down into Fremont and get somebody up here, because people down there are listening too, and, you know, they need the same, they have the same rights to access the airwaves. 3 years ago now, I started thinking more about the whole community thing. Had the option of taking over the lease on the space our former studio was in over on Folsom Street. And it was like, wow, for the $1,200 I'm going to pay for this space here that's, like, totally hidden, closed away, and, like, you know, elusive, I could get a retail spot in the Mission and just make us completely blatant and put us in the public space. So I'm like, yeah, that would be brilliant. So I went and started looking around, found this place, negotiated a pretty good commercial lease, and opened this place up, and, you know, had, like, people help out and everything. And I think we spent, like, $3,000 to $4,000 to open this place and illegally build out the studio and everything without permits. But we opened it. And so now it's, like, this great community experiment where, one, there's not, like, one person financially supporting the station. It's the community supporting the station. So the FCC can't come, theoretically, shouldn't be able to come and fine one person for operating PirateCat, because everyone around here that comes in and buys a cup of coffee, they blatantly know they're supporting this pirate radio station right behind them as they're getting their coffee. So everyone's an accomplice. You can't, like, just go to one person. It's like the whole community is responsible for this station being here. And, you know, at the same time, it's been interesting because I had to get all of our on-air staff away from the concept of just, like, being alone in a booth with walls and a microphone in front of you. So now they've got this big window. You have to have interviews. You have to have something going on. You have to basically, like, when people come in, let them know that you're there and that you're not just, like, playing music or doing an interview, but you also want them to come in and talk about whatever it is they want to talk about. Anyway, the other way that we've been able to have the cafe here is that I personally, well, I have to say this, like, I have to, like, state this now. I don't operate transmitters illegally. Fans of PirateCat Radio operate transmitters illegally and rebroadcast our internet feed. So, you know, fans would go and put up a transmitter, use this wartime act, and basically, you know, just rebroadcast anything we had streaming over the web, and all that content comes from here. So, hey, that's cool. People are rebroadcasting us, and you can hear us all over the Bay Area. So in April of 2008, a commercial licensed radio station in New Mexico, known as AO Communications, I don't know what their actual license was, they utilized the Wartime Act improperly and started using it to rebroadcast their commercial radio station a few miles outside their broadcast range. And the FCC caught wind of it and was like, well, you can't do this. One, you're a commercial radio station, and, you know, whatever. So they took them to court, and this radio station had enough money to go to court with the FCC and battle over it. It took them a year, but in April 2009, they lost the case with the FCC, and the FCC set new precedent, which basically allowed them to rewrite the rule, saying that they have to issue the license instead. So you can't just go on the air with it and send them the thing saying we're doing this. They have to actually accept it. So they were shut down, and basically, you know, that happened in April 2009. Then in August 2009, we got fined, or I personally was fined $10,000 for broadcasting without a license. It's kind of a funny thing because I haven't operated a transmitter or had a transmitter in, like, any residence that I've had in the past 6 years. How can you fine me for something that I've always complied with and stopped, and I'm not actually doing it, somebody else? So that's our whole battle with the FCC right now. So that's not going to be, you know, no decision's going to be made as to whether our fine is reduced or thrown out or whatever the case may be for 8 months to 2 years. So it's just this, like, limbo for a long time.
So basically you're waiting for them. I mean, is there a court case, or, like, you're just waiting for them to make
so
a decision arbitrarily?
It's really, so what happened is they gave me a notice of apparent liability saying that I'm liable $10,000 for broadcasting without a license. Michael Cousins, our attorney, wrote the response to them saying that, you know, Monkey is not liable for this because all he does is run, you know, an internet radio station out of this cafe in the Mission District that acts as a community radio station. If other people rebroadcast that, it's not his, he's not responsible for it. Which, yeah, totally. I'll take that. So, that's basically our argument with the FCC at the moment. And it's funny because I guess between April and August of last year, the FCC actually had people come in, sit down, buy cups of coffee, take pictures, sit in vans across the street and watch things. And there's like a specific day in May that they cite in the NAL where they actually had a person sitting outside in a van watching me. And they're like, well, we observed Monkey Daniel Roberts operating an espresso machine and operating a board. Like, well, great. I don't think it's illegal to operate an espresso machine in the state of California or in the U.S. I don't know. I've never heard that it was illegal to do that. But that's what they've got me for. And since they've done that, you know, people have caught wind of our fine. And from Vancouver to the capital city of Honduras, I mean, literally there's like 8 different transmitters up right now along the West Coast rebroadcasting Pirate Cap. Other people are doing it from Canada to, you know, different countries, all, you know, different states even. They're rebroadcasting this. I have nothing to do with it. So, you know, we'll see what happens when, you know, they finally make their decision. I mean, we even have a woman who's talking about donating us an actual license for a radio station in the Bay Area. I've started doing some legwork on that already, and our attorney has started doing some legwork on it as well, and realized that there's this big Christian fundamentalist organization from Florida out here in the Bay Area that will like be the first ones to oppose this transfer to us. So we're kind of preparing for all that, which is proving to be a lot of fun. This is getting into a whole nother realm of FCC law that I never thought I would deal with, and it's proving to be even more interesting than running a pirate radio station. So we're waiting to see what happens with that, and we could be on the air with a license as soon as April. And, you know, some people would say that, well, aren't you guys kind of like selling out, or are you just like giving up by, you know, following the rules? I'm like, well, yeah, we're complying a little bit, but we always have been to some extent. I mean, we make sure we're not interfering with anyone, any other broadcasts around the Bay Area, whether that's radio or emergency or, you know, for aircraft. Plus, you know, we've been following this whole wartime loophole, which is, you know, there are rules set there. So interviews, PSAs, providing a community service, doing everything we should be doing, which people seem to respect and understand. So, yeah, we've already been following the rules. The only thing we can't do now is say fuck. And
The issue of, like, sort of selling out or whatever, transforming Pirate Cat from a pirate radio station to a community radio station without license or whatever, it's a really interesting question because I just sort of wonder, like, what you see the role of pirate radio being, first of all, and then the second part of the question would be, like, why do you think the FCC feels like it has to, or the government feels like it has to regulate the airwaves? You know what I mean? What is it about pirate radio that poses a threat?
So the concept is that the FCC was created to allow communities and areas to have radio stations. Whether those were community or commercial, it doesn't matter. They just were there to regulate the creation of radio stations to make sure that they're not interfering with each other and that they're all able to broadcast within their license areas respectfully. So the FCC is, you know, they've done that, but it's gone to a further extent with them where they've, you know, there are a lot of things in the Communications Act of 1934 that stipulates that, you know, they're supposed to, well, the content of radio stations should serve the areas they broadcast to. I think they've let a lot of things from the Communications Act of 1934 go to the wayside and don't really pay attention to it anymore. I mean, that's, I think, obviously shown when you have stations like Live 105 putting out 12,000 kilowatts of power. It's like, well, how is that beneficial to a community to have a radio station that covers this massive area and they just play music all the time? You're basically like kicking out all these other cities and communities from having their own unique personal community radio station, because there's this massive giant on top of everyone. And at the same time, the FCC doesn't want to see those stations go away, because now the airwaves have become something more than just a thing to regulate, but it's become real estate. So every time there's like a transfer of a major license, the FCC gets money. If they don't get money, there are various engineers that get money from having to go and do the surveys and process all the, you know, paperwork that's concerned for transferring licenses or even starting a license. Application fees really aren't, you know, the FCC's way of making money. It's always like third-party sources, other engineers that make money off of doing surveys and everything. There's like a whole economy there. Now there's you know, since 1997, there are new rules where basically radio stations have to declare how much money they brought in. So let's say Live 105, for example, they have to declare how much ad revenue they bring in, and they have to report that to the FCC. The FCC just wants to see that they're continuously making money. If they stop making money, then they'll go and say, oh, we're going to take your license away because you're not making enough money with this thing. And it's totally absurd. It's like your whole focal point now is protect these people with licenses from people interfering with them, namely pirates, and make sure that license stations are all making money. And, you know, the reason why the FCC doesn't want pirates around is because, you know, their primary interest, and something that I think is necessary, is to regulate interference between other radio frequencies. Which is why I took such strenuous efforts in making sure that we weren't interfering with anything licensed in any form with PirateCat. And I think I should say as well that, like, it's horrible to hear about the things that are happening in Central America with pirate radio stations, and the fact that they have to deal with, you know, being, like, shot and killed, or, you know, being beaten because they have, you know, a radio station. And, like, you know, we don't have to deal with that here, and we're really lucky and privileged in the U.S. to not have to deal with, you know, this, like, supreme repression of the government to keep us off the air. I mean, here it's just, like, yeah, financial threats and the threat of, like, a little bit of jail time if you don't comply with that, but it's nothing like what people have to deal with elsewhere around the world. Like, we have it easy here. We have it really, really easy here.
En la mañana de este pasado 6 de enero, la radio comunitaria Faluma Bimetu de la comunidad garífuna Triunfo de la Cruz en Honduras fue atacada y destruida por hombres encapuchados y fuertemente armados. Esta semana, del 1 al 7 de febrero, una brigada internacional está en Triunfo de la Cruz reconstruyendo la radio. Entrevistamos a uno de los compañeros de la radio Faluma Bimetu, quien nos habla de su lucha.
Faluma Bimetu nace por allá en 1995 a raíz del pleito precisamente en contra del desarrollo de los megaproyectos turísticos que plantean la privatización de la propiedad comunitaria. Entonces, en ese sentido, se nos negaba todos los espacios en los medios de comunicación masivos y los medios de comunicación escritos que están manejados por los mismos, y eso catapultó, como quien dice, la idea de que necesitábamos nuestros propios medios de comunicación para tener los espacios de hacer nuestras propias denuncias. Esa es la idea de Faluma Bimetu, 1995, y dos años después estábamos haciendo nuestra primera transmisión en 1997. Dentro de los objetivos de la radio es educar y generar cambios de opinión y de pensamiento, mantener y recuperar todo el arraigo cultural. El pueblo garífuna está aquí en Honduras desde el año 1700. Somos 46 comunidades y estamos en todo lo largo de la costa caribe hondureña. Por eso hay una amplia zona de playas muy bellas. Muchas personas dicen que es el paraíso. Por lo tanto, ahora los desarrolladores de los megaproyectos y las municipalidades, que son las llamadas a mantener estas culturas vivas y sostenerlas, son los mismos que están atentando en contra de nuestro pueblo. Nosotros entendemos que hay instituciones financieras como el Banco Mundial, el BID, el Banco Interamericano de Desarrollo y otros de financiamiento internacional y la banca privada nacional. Es un pequeño grupo de empresarios que manejan esto como verdaderos carteles y que pretenden la privatización como una estrategia para poder liquidar nuestros títulos colectivos. Lo que plantean ellos es atentar en contra de las costumbres de los pueblos, porque el pueblo garífuna, uno de los sustentos fundamentales es la navegación, la pesca y el libre acceso a las playas, y ellos, una vez que se apropian de estas playas, vienen los cercos y vienen los vigilantes armados. Entonces viene una interferencia directa en la vida de nuestras comunidades, y al no hallar las comunidades una forma de vida adecuada que les permita vivir y sostener a su familia, entonces se ven obligados a emigrar. Y eso es lo que nosotros estamos tratando de concientizar a nuestra población, de que no debemos de claudicar, porque la propuesta de desarrollo es una propuesta de desarrollo para ellos, pero no para los pueblos. Para los pueblos lo que viene es más hambre, más pobreza, y eso es de eso se trata, permanentes campañas de concientización de nuestra población. Y sin duda alguna, hasta ahora, proyectos como los nuestros han tenido una incidencia, porque si no, no fuéramos objeto de estos atentados. El día que se dio el golpe de Estado, al día siguiente nosotros fuimos llamados por la resistencia a Tegucigalpa, y con un grupo de corresponsales estuvimos en Tegucigalpa cubriendo el golpe, informando a nuestra gente, porque se clausuraron muchos medios de comunicación y solo había espacio para los medios de comunicación masivos. Y hubo un momento que fuimos detenidos también en el mes de octubre, juntamente con todos nuestros corresponsales garífunas, más de 14 personas, fuimos metidos a la cárcel sin ningún motivo aparente, y gracias a los abogados de la resistencia, que solo tuvimos 5 horas detenidos. También como antecedente fue clausurada Radio Globo, y nosotros estuvimos sacando la señal por internet, y una semana después teníamos la visita de la policía con amenaza de cierre. Estas y otras cosas son las que se dan porque nosotros estamos claramente definidos que los enemigos tradicionales del pueblo garífuna para el desarrollo de los megaproyectos turísticos son los mismos golpistas. En el 2002 hubo el robo y saqueo totalmente del equipo, el cual nos mantuvo fuera del aire por más de un año. Sin embargo, este ataque fue mucho más violento. Prácticamente se quemó media casa y se quemó el equipo, y el equipo que no lograron quemar se lo robaron. Acabábamos de finalizar una ampliación de la radio y el aumento de la potencia de la radio. Habían 4 hombres fuertemente armados con capuchas, y eso intimidó a nuestros compañeros a salir en primera instancia porque se pensó que pudiera haber un atentado. Las únicas personas armadas en este momento, porque estamos viviendo dentro del golpe de Estado un plan de desarme general, por lo tanto los únicos que andan armados son la policía y las autoridades.
Claro.
No solo la represión ha aumentado en contra nuestra como pueblo y negros e indígenas aquí en Honduras, sino que también la cantidad de muertos. Nosotros como pueblo garífuna, solo nosotros tenemos más de 15 personas asesinadas. El último asesinado fue un compañero pescador que andaba faenando cerca de una zona protegida y fue ametrallado por policías de la naval. acabamos de recibir la sentencia donde participaron 6 policías. Y porque dijo el juez que no se sabe qué arma fue la que disparó de esos policías, fueron exonerados de libre culpa todos estos policías, sin que se pudiera juzgar al oficial que andaba encargado de la patrulla. Sí han habido bastantes muertos, encarcelamientos, amenazas permanentes para que podamos desistir de seguir reclamando nuestro derecho. Nosotros, por nuestra parte, ni las balas, ni los asesinatos, ni las bombas lacrimógenas, ni la cárcel nos van a hacer desistir de seguir al lado de nuestro pueblo, exigiendo que se respete nuestro derecho a vivir como pueblo. Somos un pueblo en lucha permanente. No estamos resistiendo desde el 28, estamos resistiendo casi más de 500 años ahora.
Esta semana, además de la Brigada Internacional para Reconstruir Radio Faluma Bimetu, la Organización Fraternal Negra de Honduras está visitando otras radios comunitarias garífunas de la región. El 6 de febrero, justo un mes después del ataque a Radio Faluma Bimetu, se está realizando un encuentro por el derecho a la comunicación y a la democratización de los medios de comunicación en la comunidad de Triunfo de la Cruz, con la participación de la Red de Radios Indígenas y Garífunas de Centroamérica, la AMARC, la ALBA TV de Venezuela, Rights Action, COMPA, OFRANE, COPIN y otras organizaciones nacionales e internacionales. El mismo día se reinaugurará Radio Faluma Bimetu.
Check it, check it, wah, wah, yo, 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 yo.
Okay, what we just heard was an interview that happened with a radio station in Honduras, on the northern coast of Honduras, called Faluma Bimetu, which means sweet coconut. And it's a Garifuna radio station. The Garifuna are a group of black people who inhabit the coast of the Caribbean coast of Latin America. A lot of them came from the Caribbean islands, escaped from slave plantations back in the day in the colonial period, and sort of started to inhabit the coasts. And so they have their own sort of communities, their own languages, their own needs, and they have this radio station in this one part of Honduras. It's called Triunfo de la Cruz. And their radio station has been very active in fighting against the coup that happened in Honduras over the summer, but also more generally against sort of the development of the coast for touristic purposes. So they've been really focused on identifying the sources of foreign capital that are coming into the coast, and building hotels that are building ecotourism sort of resorts and stuff like that, and taking it away from the people who occupy that area. So, what we see here is what we were mentioning before, an example of a community radio station that sort of represents the needs of a very specific community in a very specific place, and is trying to confront the incursion of foreign capital. And in response to that, a group of armed soldiers come in, basically, and burn down their radio station and steal all the equipment. That's the kind of thing that people have to face, that alternative radio has to face in other areas, not necessarily in the United States. As we heard in the Pirate Cat interview, in the United States, we don't have to face that kind of stuff. We have different forms of oppression. That doesn't necessarily mean it's better here, that all the situation is great, but it's just different forms of oppression. And that's one of the questions that we're interested in trying to answer, trying to sort of tease out what kinds of oppression there is.
Yeah, and I think if we talk about what was just said with the stakes, if you look at what it means to occupy occupy down in Honduras, and then what the Pirate Cat struggle here of actually having a physical space, I think partly up here in the global north, we have the privilege of being able to, if you will, get away with a little bit more, in the sense of the Pirate Cat, they pay rent for a space, they actually have a cafe, and they work out of there, in the sense that I don't think that would necessarily exist down in Honduras. So, again, it just begs the question of what role does the media play, pirate radio play, in the sense of struggle? And we also have to beg the question of why isn't there more pirate radio stations popping up in the Bay Area, and if the Bay Area has really totally used pirate radio to its full potential.
Basic laws that anything that goes down on the oppressed people, on the part of the oppressor, it should be reciprocal. And in plain proletarian workers' language, it takes two to tango. As soon as these motherfuckers go, we go.
They let you ask some questions, but they kill the ones with answers. Look what happened to them Panthers. Raise your hand if you know someone with cancer. Now make a fist if you piss, it's our family miss. Civil rights, yeah, we learn cause it's safer schools. But I'm tired of being civil, where's the other views? Teacher, teacher, I have a dream as well. And in this dream, Fred Hampton told me give him hell. I try to tell him we gotta rebel. We all have our freedom songs to sing and tell. I chose to fill the beat to pass it along as the horns carry these words on and on. I try to tell him we gotta rebel. Words on and on. If my word is my weapon, then I plan on using it. Pass a paper and a pen, cause I stay remembering all the things in my life. Now that Tommy hate myself, so I rage like Zach did. Don't try to calm me down, we don't listen to the ones only preaching, cause we can't relate. I listen to my heart tick down a detonate. I'm not asking for permission just to march against. Type of fight I want, no need for permits. I ain't the type of slave to ask if I could run away. So many different masters, so many different chains. Uncolonize my colonized, colonized self. I stand in solidarity cause we need the help. Don't try to stop my vehicle cause you don't like my ride. There's room on this long road, many different styles. PLG Quilombo art, now you know that's mine. And it's ready to explode, these are our times. I try to tell them we gotta rebel. We all have our freedom songs to sing and tell. I chose to fill the beat to pass it along as the horns carry these words on and on. I try to tell them we gotta rebel. We all have our freedom songs to sing and tell. I chose to fill the beat to pass it along as the horns carry these words on and on. Now, bring the light, this a fuse, yes it explodes. We got the recipe for more, time to let them know what they up against. No longer sitting in, no longer words on signs, no longer idling. This is a Porsche weapon, click clack. So many different stages, this the first act. How the story ends, whatever I imagine. Plan it out, visualize, and I make it happen. I have a lot of hope, but not your White House resident. I voted fella Cootie for my president. Start campaigning Dave Chappelle in 2012. We need another block party right about now. Part two, yeah, we going international. Music shows, mad love, unconditional. Call the homies up, everyone's invited. Let's get this party started, yeah, ignite it. I try to tell them we gotta rebel. We all have our freedom songs to sing and tell. I chose to fill the beat to pass it along as the horns carry these words on and on. I try to tell them we gotta rebel. We all have our freedom songs to sing and tell. I chose to fill the beat to pass it along as the horns carry these words on and on.
You are listening to Berkeley Liberation Radio, 104.1 FM. This is Relato Zapatista, and your Super Bowl destination station for today. The score, actually, is 13-10. The Saints are up. Woo-hoo! We'll be back after this musical break from New Orleans with some info on spoken word artists from Haiti. Enjoy.
Están escuchando Relato Zapatista en Radio Berkeley Liberation Radio 104.1, www.berkeleyliberationradio.net. Ahorita lo que vamos a ver es un trabajo de spoken word desde México sobre y para Haití. Como ya sabemos, el 12 de enero, un terremoto devastador sacudió a la capital haitiana de Puerto Príncipe, causando inmensa destrucción y la muerte de más de 100.000 personas. La reacción de los Estados Unidos ha sido una de militarización, con el ejército gabacho controlando todo el esfuerzo de apoyo supuestamente humanitario. En un nuevo artículo publicado el 1 de febrero, el periodista y activista Raúl Sibeki, quien ha escrito mucho sobre el zapatismo, analiza la reacción de Obama y dice, cito, "Con la crisis haitiana, la militarización de las relaciones entre Estados Unidos y América Latina avanza un poco más, como parte de la militarización de toda la política exterior de Washington. De ese modo, la superpotencia en declive intenta retardar el proceso que la convertirá en una potencia entre otras 6 o 7 en el mundo. La intervención es tan desembozada que el periódico oficialista chino Diario del Pueblo se pregunta si Estados Unidos pretende incorporar a Haití como un estado más de la Unión. Fin de cita. Las respuestas a la crisis en Haití se pueden entender claramente dentro del marco del argumento de Naomi Klein en la doctrina del shock, ya que lo que vemos ocurriendo actualmente es un ejemplo más del capitalismo del desastre. Y es esencial que mantengamos una perspectiva crítica y activa sobre el contexto haitiano en los meses y años que vienen. Desde el Distrito Federal, nuestros compañeros del colectivo Quilombo Arte prepararon y grabaron una serie de spoken words para Haití que se puede encontrar en YouTube. Si busca spoken word boca floja Quilombo Arte en YouTube, ahí lo encuentra, hay un video. Ahora mismo vamos a escuchar el audio de las tres piezas que hicieron. Primero uno por el hip hopero mexicano Boca Floja, luego uno por la artista y poeta Michelle Rodríguez y finalmente una pieza por el poeta y escritor Fabián Villegas. Y para los que están aquí en el área de la Bahía, Boca Floja estará tocando un show con MC Cambio y para la gente este viernes 12 de febrero en el Cypress Lounge en Santa Cruz. Aquí va el spoken word.
¿Cómo venderle el cuento a Ciudad del Sol que esto fue un instante de mala fortuna? Un accidente con diarias réplicas en silencio por siglos. Bloqueo, desconocimiento, exterminio y asco. Todo se remonta al asco. Pregúntale al comemierda jacobino por qué el concepto de ciudadano bajo este sol no es aplicable. Él formuló la respuesta en Roma. Bendecida en oro dulce, sabor de caña, sangre y azúcar. ¿Cómo hacerle el cuento a Ciudad del Sol que el pánico es efímero y el siguiente día siempre benévolo? Cuando la benevolencia cuesta caro desde Luis XIV. Cuando el altruismo es un velatorio auspiciado, aún del tiempo calculado. Hoy Benedicto se masturba extasiado por la razón de su liturgia y el casco azul interpone su naturaleza bucanera. Tira el vudú a la fosa común, hijo de más, con su psicología. Regula el hacinamiento. Dice que del cólera no hay más responsable que un mal viento en mal momento. ¿Cómo decirle a Ciudad del Sol que suelte el brazo a la jeringa con confianza cuando la sangre del hombre negro fue prohibido por la Cruz Rojiza y el bruto entrega un peso para lavar el peso y financiarle un beso a la ignorancia? ¿Cómo pedirte, Ciudad del Sol, que no revientes si es tu derecho? ¿Cómo decirte que lo revientes y con provecho? Puedo entenderte que una botella de agua con 4 latas jamás será un precio justo para someterte al orden de su filantropía colonizadora. Quiero decirte, Ciudad del Sol, que el otro sol refleja sombra. Quiero decirte, Ciudad del Sol, que en este sol hay otra sombra que celebra cuando nuestra sea la historia. Ciudad del Sol, un otro sol.
La isla se sacudió, pero no para quitarse el polvo y la tristeza, o toda su miseria. Se sacudió, haciendo advertencia del olvido y del capricho de la colonización. La isla se sacudió matándonos a todos, matándonos con la sangre coagulada, el olor a descomposición, la desesperación y la ingenuidad. La ingenuidad de que del otro lado no hay culpas ni cuestiones por emancipar, de que del otro lado desaparecen las afrentas entre Jordans y aretes platinados, entre cervezas frías y miradas indiscretas. La ingenuidad de que del otro lado, nuestro lado, no ocurre nada. Mientras se quedan esperando a unos héroes malogrados para que lo reparen todo. Porque en nuestra isla estamos muy cansados para hacerlo nosotros, cansados del viento fresco del mar y la música de palos, cansados de disfrutar las ilusiones que el capitalismo ha impuesto, cansados para tratar de asumir otra postura que no sea la del esclavo. Es por eso que nuestra isla se sacude, tiembla y se asume a sí misma indivisible. La isla, nuestra isla, ¿qué importa? Aún seguimos preocupados por la manera más efectiva de mimetizar las grandes cantidades de melanina de nuestros cuerpos, haciendo humanidad, una humanidad que animaliza el cuerpo entre escombros, al secuestro de comida por el hambre desmedida que animaliza y justifica el desastre, la podredumbre, los gusanos y la muerte, a la negritud. Una humanidad que espía la culpa de nuestro lado, con conservas de alimentos y hospitales saturados. Pero la isla, nuestra isla, ¿qué importa? Es por eso que la isla se sacude haciendo advertencia del olvido y del capricho de la colonización. Apoyo sin reparo a mi extensión de casa, Haití.
Es un teatro revolucionario, es un teatro revolucionario donde no hace falta restar lección. Corre, hermano, corre, corre, hermano, corre. Sobre el suplicio de la carne de mi carne y sobre la anulación de la metáfora como principio de esperanza, bautizaron con hisopos, cruces, vinadinos y espadas violentamente las heridas coloniales que la cristiandad latina naturalizó para descubrir su pureza y supremacía continental. África dejó de ser Libia cuando el Atlántico desplazó la centralidad del Mediterráneo como circuito comercial. África dejó de ser Libia cuando en el siglo XVI el norte de África se convirtió en el refugio de los moros expulsados de Europa. Corre, hermano, corre, corre, hermano, corre. África dejó de ser Libia cuando el África subsahariana se convirtió en el territorio donde los traficantes, geógrafos, historiadores y naturalistas iban a cazar, a matar por un sinónimo, a demostrar que en la historia y sus crónicas los eufemismos con sangre entran, a convencerte que la palabra de Dios surcaba por las aguas de la expansión, a convencerte que la esclavitud tenía como sinónimo africanidad y negritud, a convencerte que tu sangre, el tributo que tenías que pagar para dejar de ser, es ser que no es, el estigma y la marca de la colonialidad del ser, a convencerte que tu sudor y sacrificio era el tributo que tenías que pagar para dejar de ser, pues la tesis esencial del cristianismo como poder de Estado advirtió que el nuevo mundo nace bajo el signo del suplicio y la muerte del inocente, y no es que seamos inocentes, es que el cristianismo como poder de Estado le gusta llamarnos violenta y amablemente inocentes a las víctimas de la pigmentocracia colonial. Y no es que el sudor sea un tributo, es que el sudor ejemplifica el poder de la biopolítica en la diáspora como principio de gobernabilidad. Es valor de cambio en el sistema mundo moderno colonial. África dejó de ser Libia cuando Dios puso un látigo en el mando del mayoral. África dejó de ser Libia cuando la rentabilidad de la colonia y las esculturas del azúcar tenían como acoplamiento teórico Montesquieu, Linneo y Descartes y su estúpido cientificismo racial. África dejó de ser Libia cuando el virus, la desterritorialización, el arcabuz y la higiene fueron los elementos ideológicos de la colonialidad sobre los que sostiene Francia y su viejo estado territorial, posteriormente Occidente y su ejercicio imperial colonial. África dejó de ser Libia cuando valientemente renunciaste a la América Latina y a la América anglosajona, cuando renunciaste ferozmente a asimilarte en el estúpido concepto de América Latina, pues reproducía los borramientos de la colonialidad. África dejó de ser Libia cuando la Carta Universal de los Derechos del Hombre no reconoció como humanos y portadores de dignidad jurídica y cívica a la nación que se declaró negra, y los filibusteros humanistas seguían argumentando que la negritud era un nervio irreconciliable con la humanidad y el contrato social. África dejó de ser Libia cuando la libertad y la emancipación, categorías de la burguesía secular, asumían que la condena estaba en la biología, que la colonia de convictos era culpable por su biología. África dejó de ser Libia cuando Bolívar te traicionó, te dio la espalda y no te incluyó en su proyecto de una América Latina como unidad política y administrativa. África dejó de ser Libia cuando la izquierda latinoamericana surgió la ideología criolla barroca como pensamiento decolonial. Cuando las estúpidas arcas independentistas de Latinoamérica solo reconocían al mestizo como el bendecido y el bautizado de su taxonomía racial. África dejó de ser Libia cuando te desnudaron con violencia por el monocultivo azucarero y las calamidades de una guerra contra la colonia. África dejó de ser Libia cuando la bandera de los libres se alzó sobre las ruinas de una tierra infértil y un mar de sangre donde se apagaba el tabaco y los puros del ejército colonial. África dejó de ser Libia y la ontología del cuerpo de Haití ha dejado de ser el ser para pasar a ser la salud. Haití, la herida colonial, la moral cosmopolita y la hipocresía internacional, la estratificación racial en la consolidación de los estados, la historia de Occidente, el genocidio como imperativo de configuración del sistema moderno colonial e imperial, el capitalismo del desastre, la capitalización de la sociedad de riesgo y la crisis como una oportunidad de inversión imperial. Haití, imposibilitado para levantarse, pide ayuda bajo el ritmo sincopado de una voz histórica que le antecede. Es el abolengo de la sangre de nuestra sangre, el ritmo que busca políticamente nullificar el cromatismo de la dominación. Haití, por ti tenemos el inconsciente encadenado sociológicamente. La historia es un olvido, no más sueños con sangre y algodón. seguido por castillos, flores y arquitecturas de sangre con azúcar.
We just heard this piece from Mexico City, from the Quilombo Arte Collective, a series of three spoken words in honor of and dedicated to the people of Haiti. Now we just want to do a little bit of follow-up on our coverage of the UC student movement and the ongoing movement in defense of public education throughout the state. In the last few shows, we've been featuring segments about particular actions and particular sort of events taking place on UC campuses, and this is something we're going to continue to cover. So recently, just this weekend actually, as we speak, the students of UC Davis are continuing with an all-weekend study-in at the UC Davis Shields Library. This was an openly announced event that was set to be a study-in where folks were just going to take control of the library and stay all weekend. The library, which normally closes very early every weekend day. And what happened was the chancellor of UC Davis sent out a very tactful email on Thursday announcing that they wanted to avoid any potential conflict with the protesters, and they decided to keep the library open 24 hours over the course of the weekend. While we can see this as some level of victory on the part of those organizing the study-in, it certainly is another effort by the administration to co-opt the student actions. But the event has turned out to be quite a success with a number of workshops and teach-ins and really great speakers over the course of the weekend. So this is all in the context also of the previous actions at UC Davis in the fall, where we had 52 people arrested in November. And the track that we're going to hear right now, we're going to hear an audio track in a few seconds about, which is by MC Cambio, who is part of the Quilombo Arte Collective, again, the collective who did the spoken word that we just heard. And this track is a remix of his song, I Love College, and it's dedicated to the student movement. And this track features audio from the student-run Aggie TV station, which is a television station at UC Davis, which provided really unique and very important coverage of the 2009 November sit-in and arrest at UC Davis.
And I just wanted to say, I wanted to throw out there one more time that we heard at the beginning of the show, we heard that call, the call to action for March 4th. And, you know, our show is at the beginning of each month, the first Sunday of every month. So I'm not sure what the first Sunday of March is. I think it's going to be after March 4th. So we wanted to really get people to hear this call and to recognize, to acknowledge what's going on and what's going to be happening in the Bay Area. March 4th is going to be a big day of action. There's going to be a huge march from Berkeley to Oakland of people from at least from the Berkeley campus, but also it's going to be there's going to be a meetup from all the different like elementary schools and secondary schools in sort of the East Bay. Everybody's going to meet up at Frank Ogawa Plaza, which is right in front of the sort of city hall of Oakland. And it's going to be a mass convergence of all different sectors of the public education in California. And it's going to be going on all over. So that's the action in the East Bay, but there's another action in San Francisco. There's going to be actions all over the state in Los Angeles. There's going to be solidarity actions all over the country and even all over the world. We recently heard about some Japanese students who got arrested in Japan for putting out flyers for an action on that they want to have on March 4th in solidarity with what's going on in the United States. So this is going to be a really serious day, and we just really wanted to emphasize the importance of this since we've been following the struggle from the very beginning. So let's listen to that. Let's listen to that song from MC Cambio.
Shortly after the UC Board of Regents approved a 32% increase in undergraduate student piece, students gathered inside Barack Hall while trying to engage in conversation with university representatives. At approximately 5:15 p.m., police warned students inside the building that they were subject to arrest for trespassing. Students remained in solidarity.
Check. I recall, yo, the first day moving in. Shared a room with a white guy, crazy man. He played guitar and I told him I rap. Now he plays the bass line and his name be Zach. And we rock college parties, yo, as a new man. And I played a little golf, bet you didn't know that. But the coach was a racist, so I called him one. But I just read David's Iron, so I was on some. Mr. Bay were conservative assholes, and they the biggest haters, so I had to let them know. I respect all the students, man, that's sitting in, like my little cousin Juan, man, I'm so proud of him.
Tensions escalated as police established a perimeter, blockading both entrances to Black Hall. Although police continued to give multiple warnings, students responded by chanting louder. Students then unified by linking arms and forming a circle as police gave their last word.
UCDPD's been here since about 1 o'clock, and they called in all of these subsequent officers because they didn't feel they could handle the protesters, even though there hasn't been a single violent outbreak.
Check it out, the second verse dedicated to the high life. Pass the weed, but I'm talking more tuition hikes. For the ones gotta work 10 jobs to pay for the books, leave the store feeling robbed. Damn, they never showed us in the movies. People dropping like the pennies of a booby. And even if you graduate, where you getting hired? No jobs, I'm depressed. Damn, Gambio, you're fired. What you want me to say? What if I rap about tits, blunts, and getting laid? Hot girls getting faded, homie, then could I say? But then I'd be Asher Roth, no way.
Around 7:20 p.m. and students remain non-aggressive in their continued support for students being escorted out individually by police.
I love college. To all the organizers, to all the students, I see you. I got my fist raised.
So you're listening to Berkeley Liberation. You're listening to Berkeley Liberation Radio, and this is Relato Zapatista. And we're actually going to come to a closing with our show with a Doritos story time or story hour. And this show, we're going to actually read a communique called Apples and the Zapatistas, and it comes from a book actually called Conversations with Dorito. So we will commence with that story.
This communique is entitled Apples and the Zapatistas. The last story of this volume marks Dorito's first appearance in the editorial pages of Rebel Dia, a new magazine from the Mexican left. Here Dorito describes how the seeds sown by the Zapatistas will grow and bear fruit, giving sustenance to generations to come. Dorito says that life is like an apple. He also says that there are those who eat them green, those who eat them rotten, and those who eat them ripe. Dorito says that there are some, very few, who can choose how they eat an apple, either in a beautiful fruit arrangement, pureed, in one of those odious to Dorito, apple sodas, in juice, in cake, in cookies, or whatever their gastronomy dictates. Dorito says that the indigenous people feel obligated to eat the rotten apple, that the consumption of green apples is imposed upon youth, that children are promised a beautiful apple, all the while it's poisoned with worms of deceit, and that women are told that they will be given an apple but only get half an orange. Dorito says that life is like an apple. He also says that when a Zapatista is faced with an apple, he stands vigilant, with his blade ready, and with a skillful slice he cuts the apple in half. Dorito says that the Zapatista neither intends to eat the apple, nor is he interested in whether the apple is ripe, rotten, or green. Dorito says that while the heart of the apple is exposed, the Zapatista, with great care, removes the seeds, then tills a parcel of land and plants the seeds. Next, says Dorito, the Zapatista waters a little plant with his tears and blood and guards its growth. Dorito says that the Zapatista will not even see the apple tree blossom, much less the fruit it will give. Dorito says that the Zapatista planted the apple tree so that one day, when he is not here, just about anyone would be able to cut a ripe apple and be free to eat it, either in a fruit arrangement, pureed as juice, in pie, or in one of those odious to Dorito apple sodas. Dorito says that the Zapatista problem is this, to plant the seed and guard its growth. Dorito says that the problem for everyone else is to struggle to be free, to choose how to eat the apple that will come. Dorito says that this is the difference between the Zapatistas and the rest of humanity. Where everyone sees an apple, the Zapatista sees a seed, grows and cultivates the land, plants the seed and guards it. Outside of that, says Dorito, we Zapatistas are like the kid next door. If anything, we're uglier, says Dorito, while watching from the corner of his eye as I take off my ski mask. Subcomandante Insurgente Marcos, from some dawn in the 21st century.
Por aquí a mi despido, con sentimiento y dolor.